Off funny and warm. I'm a good man in a storm, and when the fall is torrential, I'll recall. Shamika said I had potential. 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 Shamika said I had potential.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org. Well, we start off saying that all things are not going well right now in Washington.
Some brand new reporting in the New York Times today on a confrontation of sorts inside the White House between Elon Musk and several members of Donald Trump's new cabinet, with Donald Trump sort of reduced to the role of spectator. The Times cites five people with knowledge of the confrontation, reports this about an argument between Elon Musk and Marco Rubio. Quote, "You fired nobody," Musk told Rubio, then scornfully added that perhaps the only person he had fired was a staff member from his Department of Government Efficiency. Rubio had been privately furious with Musk for weeks, ever since his Doge team effectively shuttered an entire agency that was supposedly under Rubio's control, the United States Agency for International Development. Musk was not being truthful, Rubio said. What about the more than 1,500 State Department officials who took early retirement in buyouts? Didn't they count as layoffs, he asked sarcastically, whether Musk wanted him to rehire all those people just so he can make a show of firing them again. Then he laid out his detailed plans for reorganizing the State Department. Musk was unimpressed. He told Rubio he was, quote, good on TV, with the clear subtext being he wasn't good for much else. Where was Donald Trump in all this? The Times reports that he sat back as if he was watching a tennis match. Ultimately, he, quote, intervened to defend, wait for it, Rubio. Said he was doing a great job. Rubio has a lot to deal with, the president said. He's very busy. He's always traveling and on TV. And he has an agency to run. So everyone just needs to work together, end quote. And then for the first time since his inauguration, Trump put some restraints on Elon Musk. From this reporting, quote, from now on, he said, the secretaries would be in charge. The Musk team will only advise. Joining our coverage, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation, president of the National Action Network, the Reverend Al Sharpton joins us. Christy and Michael are still here. Rev, I have been watching the Bannon-Musk power struggle with keen interest since it first emerged during the campaign. And I think I said on television, do not ever bet against the guy who was willing to go to jail to not testify before Congress, and the guy who sort of in I don't know if his life, I don't know enough about his life, but who seems to understand the base and the most powerful elements of the Trump base better than anybody in Trump land, and that is Steve Bannon. And I don't have any idea if Bannon has any role in all this, but it does seem like Musk has stumbled, not by taking more attention from Trump, which is how most people stumble, but by dirtying him up politically. The things that Musk is doing are not popular among Republican voters in Republican districts.
That's the whole point. I think that Musk could get away with a lot, but he cannot in any way endanger his popularity. When he starts seeing polls coming down based on things that Musk got him to do or that Musk did in his name, that gets his attention. You've got to remember, a narcissist is about him. And when you are doing things that in any way injures or besmirches the image of the narcissist, he's got to react. All the logic in the world doesn't matter. Everything else doesn't matter. But wait a minute, he's making me look bad. I don't care how rich he is. And I think that that's what Musk is going to run into here.
What's interesting, though, is that this is a different Trump, because the co-presidency has been going on since the beginning, and that doesn't bother Trump. What bothers him, and what has always, I think, sustained him politically, is this reptilian survival sense that if all the Republicans are voted out of office in 2 years, that is a much bumpier road.
It's a much bumpier road. He knows that it will kill anything that he wants to leave as a legacy. And he has no way of stopping that if the polls keep dropping. I think that we really have to understand Donald Trump, at the end of the day, is about Donald Trump. And he's not going to share that with anyone. Spotlight doesn't care. He knows he's the president, and Musk is not the president and never will be. But what he doesn't want to be is an unpopular president with no legacy. He wants the Trump library. I mean, what does he do after he leaves? He can't change the law and run a third time. That's just talk. He wants the library. He wants to be respected. He wants people to want him to come around the world. And if
he's
Musk...
He's going to build Trump Mars.
That's right.
All these rocket men in his pocket.
That's right. I mean, there's a man talking about buying whole countries. I want to own green.
Yeah.
So that's how he thinks. If Musk gets in the way of that self-image that he has, as unrealistic as it may be, that is where you're going to start seeing division.
I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. Now, imagine my surprise when I pull up to the DNC, right? The Democratic National Convention. I'm here to speak to members of Congress. I'm here to watch the State of the Union. And my name not even on the list. And I was invited. On the list to get in? Sure. But when it came time to actually do anything and names were called for assignments and activities, crickets. And it wasn't just me. It was all the black creators. Had us out here looking like deers in headlights. So we left and came back home to the only place that had real space for us, the Congressional Black Caucus. Amen? I know that's right. The saying goes, don't go where you're not celebrated. But one thing about us, we have always had to carve out a space to get the job done. So, DNC, the black creators got something to say. And it's a whole hell of a lot more than the scheme set up by Todd they want to call a joint address. Elizabeth, talk to him.
The craziest thing about this administration is how they've convinced Americans that they're going to get rid of fraud, waste, and abuse by taking away critical services from you. Social Security Administration being dismantled. Department of Health and Human Services being dismantled. Department of Education being dismantled. How did they somehow convince a bunch of Americans that not giving you Social Security checks for your grandparents, health care for your families, and schools for your babies to go to is somehow good for you? That South African scammer Elon Musk has gone so far that he even convinced Americans that getting rid of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau would take away taxpayer dollar waste when it's not funded by taxpayer dollars. It's funded 100% by the Federal Reserve. $800 million goes into that agency that then saves Americans billions of dollars in protecting them from fraud every single year. So let me ask you, why would an unelected billionaire want to take away a service that prevents you from being taken advantage of by shady corporations and takes money from your pocket?
Todd, not the Todd that be setting schemes. This is another Todd.
Well, we are certainly in the middle of a hostile government takeover.
We're in the middle of a hostile government takeover.
I mean, look at all the things that are happening. People are losing jobs. People are losing health care. They're losing confidence in our government altogether. And so we need people to realize the gravity of the situation and understand what's going on, but at the same time, to not be fearful and realize that there is a path forward out of this.
Jasmine. Run it on down for him.
Although we are in a hostile administration, we can still be on the offensive. We need to resist the urge to feel jaded and discouraged, because despite what mainstream media says, we have the numbers and we are winning. I know y'all know Donald Trump has passed a whole bunch of executive orders and we feel defeated, but these executive orders are actually getting stricken down in court. Do y'all remember his DEI executive order? A Maryland judge issued an order that requires federal contractors to comply with anti-discrimination laws. So that's a win for us. Even, do y'all remember when he tried to end birthright citizenship through an executive order? A Seattle judge already halted that and said that was unconstitutional. Which is another win for us. So we are fighting back and we are winning. And don't let right-wing media confuse you.
Who's next? Go, 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 go. go.
The Black Women on a Mission are not backing down. The 92% Club has come to Congress with a list of questions, and we are here to get answers. We're going to make it happen for us, by us, all the way from our communities to Congress.
And before we go, I have to say that we're not just a bunch of unrelatable college graduates, influencers, out-of-touch people that are trying to get you to care about things that don't affect you in your everyday life. As a matter of fact, Rayshonda, I think you need to take them to the board.
Well, I don't have a board, but I will teach. I grew up in Mississippi in a small town, all black, three streetlights. We were raised to know that politics are all around us. My grandfather was always out campaigning and making sure that we elect the correct people in positions because we knew and he knew that by doing so could change generations. And that's what we are doing now. The effects of what we do today will reverberate throughout history. And that's what everybody needs to recognize. Politics are all around us. Politics dictate where we live. Politics dictate the rent that we pay, the eggs that we buy, the clothes that we put on our back. It all affects us. So we need to get right.
The following video is sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus Political Action Committee.
Renee, keeping it black and keeping it real. Also MSNBC. And we have more in the news for you this hour. Next, Don Lemon breaks it down with one of his lemon drops.
Listen, everyone, all is not well in Trumpville. And I'm going to talk to you about cabinet, or I should say palace intrigue, unlike any other. And this New York Times, there's a new New York Times report that gives us really unprecedented insight into what is happening with the Trump administration, especially between certain cabinet officials and Elon Musk. It appears to be cabinet officials, a certain few of them, versus Elon Musk. On top of that, don't be fooled. Donald Trump is running scared. He is nervous about the tariffs. He's nervous about the stock markets. Remember, he uses the stock markets to engage the overall health of the economy. And the economy's not doing great right now. Was doing better under Joe Biden. The economy's not doing great right now under his leadership or tutelage, however you want to put it. The stock market, not doing well. And his approval ratings are down. And I believe that there is internal polling showing him that Doge is dragging his approval rating down. So this remarkable meeting that happened in the White House is an explosive meeting that Trump says, the New York Times says, inside the explosive meeting where Trump officials clashed with Elon Musk. Simmering anger at the billionaire's unchecked power spilled out in a remarkable cabinet room meeting. The president quickly moved to rein in Mr. Musk. First time really that has happened. Most of this, they said, was between Marco Rubio, who is the Secretary of State, and Elon Musk, who is the head of Doge. Apparently, Elon Musk is saying in this meeting, in this reporting, that Marco Rubio did not do enough, did not fire enough people. And that started the whole thing off. This is Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman's reporting. And so they were going back and forth. And Marco Rubio says, look, a lot of people have taken early retirement. You don't see that as these people, as us saving or at least getting rid of some jobs. And then it started from there, the two men going back and forth with each other. And then also the transportation secretary, Sean Duffy, jumping in as well, scolding Mr. Musk and his Doge team, his team of young people, for wanting him to get rid of and fire FAA employees. And Duffy says, you want me to do that while planes are falling out of the sky? And he said, well, and Elon Musk says, well, you give me the names of the people that we fired. And he says, they didn't fire. Duffy says, we didn't fire them. We don't have any names because smartly, we didn't fire them even on the recommendation of you and your Doge people. Musk was not being truthful with Mr. Rubio. That's what Rubio was saying during the meeting. What about the more than 1,500 State Department officials who took early retirement buyouts? Didn't they count as layoffs? And then Musk fired back. So there's all of this going on. Donald Trump has to jump in and takes up for Marco Rubio and then set some limits on Elon Musk. People have been complaining about this sort of chainsaw aspect. And that is a quote from the New York Times, chainsaw aspect of people who are being fired by the Doge people. Donald Trump then putting out apparently after this meeting, a post saying that they would take a different approach and they would pull back on this chainsaw aspect of the firings, or at least the layoff, so to speak, of certain people. This is, people think, you guys may think that, oh my gosh, the Trump folks, they have it all together. They have every lever of government. They do have every lever of government, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branch, but they don't know how to govern. And it appears these cabinets, I guess this cabinet of what some thought would be yes men, has actually become, in certain ways, because of Marco Rubio and Sean Duffy, a cabinet of rivals. And they are pushing back hard on the things that Elon Musk is doing. And it appears that they now have the support of the president. How long that is going to last? Elon Musk saying, I know better than you because I have started and run highly successful billion-dollar businesses, so I know better than you, but has no government experience. And Marco Rubio is saying, I have more government experience than you do, and I think I know how to handle this better. The folks who are in this meeting who really spoke up were Elon Musk, Marco Rubio, Sean Duffy, Howard Lutnick, and then several cabinet secretaries. But the one who is in the most perilous position here is the Veterans Secretary, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and that is Doug Collins, because there are a number of veterans who will be affected by this and veteran services. So he is concerned that the actual constituents of Donald Trump, of MAGA, of the Republican Party, which are people who have served their countries, those people would be left out in the cold. That they will have services, they will lose services that they are entitled to and have been entitled to for as long as one can remember, for decades and decades and decades now. And therefore, Elon Musk, not knowing how the government actually works, a non-elected official or someone who is at least cutting these jobs, the president making it very clear after that meeting that Elon Musk, that his role and the DOGE role, and this is according to the reporting, would be that he was an advisor to the president and just in an advisory role and would give recommendations. The president himself reiterating that again. Apparently, the cabinet secretaries liked that, but they were afraid. They were afraid to weigh in at this meeting after, again, according to the reporting, the caustic responses and answers coming from Elon Musk, that it scared them and they were afraid to speak up. The people he's going at it with, Rubio and Duffy, calling Elon Musk out on what they were calling BS, or that he was not being truthful. Elon Musk telling Marco Rubio that you're terrible at your job, according to the reporting, and you are just good on television. And Donald Trump apparently jumped in to back up Marco Rubio and tell him he's actually doing a good job and that he's traveling a lot and that part of his role was to be on television touting the good things that the Trump administration were doing. So this is, again, more than palace intrigue, but I think this gives us an insight into how the American people are feeling. They may not be seeing it. The administration may be doing a good job of hiding what's going on behind closed doors, but the American people are not stupid. They see the chaos. They're pushing back against Republicans in deep red Republican districts at town hall meetings, pushing back against them publicly. And then, of course, that fake State of the Union that happened the other night, that joint address to Congress, I think folks are seeing through that as well, seeing through it as just sort of window dressing on an administration that is in chaos, an administration that doesn't know how to govern, an administration that is tanking the economy, an administration that is not being transparent and candid and honest with their very own voters. And so don't buy into this bluster that I am the king, I am the chosen one. We know exactly what they're doing. They don't. And if you don't believe it, look at your stock portfolio, if you're lucky to have one. Look at your retirement. Look at your 401k. And by the way, just an indication, we like to evidence and to show polls and to show numbers here, an indication of just how chaotic the American people think of this administration, the chaos that they believe it's in.
Look at this number. up 320% this term's average week versus the first term. This 46-day stretch that the Trump presidency has gone on has the most number of searches for Trump and chaos on record. The American people are seeing this. If they think that Donald Trump is like Butters in South Park, he is Professor Chaos. That is what is going on. The American people at this particular point are going, what is happening here? They are seeing Trump and they are associating him with the word chaos.
Are you okay with all of this chaos? Are the American people okay with all of the chaos? How soon before the wheels fall off? How soon before people realize that, hey, I'm getting less for my money, for my dollar. I'm getting fewer services. Costs are rising. Tariffs are problematic. And to show you just how afraid Donald Trump is, how nervous, how worried he is, in the middle of the day, out of nowhere, an impromptu meeting that he called, press briefing, that was initially supposed to be live and then it was taped, and all he did was sit there and talk about how great the tariffs are, even though the numbers don't indicate that. How much people are loving them. No one is saying how much they love the tariffs. And potentially what he's going to do to stop the war in Ukraine and Russia. There's no indication that there's anything now that's happening on the horizon. So again, smoke and mirrors, a lot of bluster, but behind the scenes, a lot of nervousness, a lot of worry that the wheels are falling off, not only on the economy, but on this administration, which is very young, only within 40 or so days in office.
Thank you, Don. And you can follow his podcast and some of the other things he's doing online by looking on YouTube and going to Don Lemon. All right, next up, we have the head of the VA administration.
The Trump administration announced it's planning to fire thousands more employees at the Department of Veterans Affairs as part of the White House effort to dramatically downsize the federal workforce. A quarter of the VA's workforce comprises veterans themselves, and that's prompting questions about how the cuts might affect the quality and timeliness of the services the VA provides. Doug Collins is the secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs and joins us now. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the NewsHour.
I'm glad to be here.
So earlier this evening, you confirmed that the VA will terminate an additional 70,000 plus staffers, and you say that these cuts will help the VA fulfill its core mission. How exactly? How is it possible to reduce staffing and resources without negatively impacting the quality and timeliness of care?
Well, the first off is I didn't announce that we're actually going through it at this moment. I said we're beginning the process to look at a reduction in force that will resemble about 15% of the force, and that's what we've begun to do. And what we've done all along is actually take a look at our core functions, making sure that the veteran is first. And it is sort of interesting to me that we say that there's no way this can affect quality of care or others, when really what we're seeing right now and we've experienced over the last few years is Washington, D.C.'s tendency to just throw money and people at problems. Over the last 4 years, there's been $130 billion added to the budget at the VA, and plus 80,000 employees. But yet, at the same time, backlogs of benefits have went up. Healthcare wait times have actually went up. And when this was all in a different position just 4 years ago. So the question is not what the, you know, where we're looking at to make sure that we're getting efficient is following what the president has called for, but also making sure that we're delivering it in the best way. And we're the best ones to look at that by actually taking our force, who is doing a great job, but saying, how can we do it more efficiently?
Well, given the VA wait times scandal during the Obama administration, the ongoing concerns about access to care for veterans, what specific safeguards are in place to ensure that veterans don't face longer delays or reduced services?
Well, I think what safeguards is employees doing their jobs, and which is what they're trying, you know, we're working to make sure they have all the tools to do that. We're also putting in place, you know, making sure that they have the critical assets to the importment schedules. We're making a look at all of how we actually deal with our hiring. Remember, one of the things we've talked about here and it's not been talked about enough is we're protecting and have protected over 300,000 positions at the VA that are that we had as mission critical, front facing to our veterans, not only in healthcare but in benefits as well. We're doing this to make sure that we're actually getting the results we needed. I think too long we found in Washington, and I've said this before, and I said it on the video earlier, that we have this idea that money and people will solve issues. And really the reality is if you don't have good processes in place, you're not going to solve the problem. This has been going on the Hill, and we've known this on Capitol Hill for years. Senator Johnny Isaacson from Georgia, who used to be the chair of the Senate VA committee, actually said this almost 10 years ago. He said the problem with the VA is not that it needs more money, and this was almost $200 billion ago. It needed a better structure, and that's what we're trying to provide.
Well, a question about the process, because our team has heard from scores of veterans who've been terminated as a result of these DOGE cuts. And there's an Air Force veteran who asked that we protect his identity. He says he was twice promoted, yet received a termination notice describing poor job performance. Take a listen.
Last week, to be locked out of my computer and told, handed a blanket termination email that was sent from OPM saying that I was being let go due to poor performance. And it's a flat out lie. It's a disgusting lie at that. I received awards from upper management, certificates. I was treated like a criminal, like I had done something wrong. They're destroying people's lives to get to these numbers that you're requesting. If you don't realize that, I'm trying to let you know now. Here's your wake-up call.
So what do you say to that? The indiscriminate or dismissive treatment that some VA staffers are describing related to their termination?
Well, one thing, this will be a probationary employee who was let go. This is where this has been coming from the process, which is an understanding we're looking at the total picture. This is an employee also that was in what was deemed out of those 300,000 plus jobs that I mentioned earlier, not a front-facing position that affects veterans' health directly or veterans' benefits directly. Look, this is something that we have. There's nothing that I take more serious than having to look at our workforce and making and having layoffs that happen. We feel for that, but it happens not only in government. It happens all across the country in many jobs that we're seeing just in the last little bit with Southwest Airlines and others who are announcing large layoffs. These are the kind of things that are hard to do, and there's something that's not easy, and I take very seriously, but also in the perspective of that we have to look out to say, are we going to be fulfilling the mission that the president has asked us to do, and that is to take care of our veterans, but also do in a cost-effective and very efficient manner. And, you know, again, one of the things that I've said here, and it's not mentioned very much in the press, is if this was a area in which it should have been flagged, or this was a mistake and it shouldn't have been part of this probationary, there is an exemption process that has been used many times, but undoubtedly in this person's case, their supervisor decided not to ask for the exemption because their position where it was and what was going on. So again, it is bad when anyone loses their job, but there have been things in place to make sure that we are trying to target as best we can the areas that we need to.
You know, veterans, as I'm sure you well know, have been hit hard across the board as it relates to these DOGE cuts, because veterans comprise nearly 30% of the federal workforce. And there are Americans who no doubt believe that people who serve their country and who continue that service through their federal job should be exempt from these firings. How do you view it?
Well, I view it as this: as someone who served for 23 years in the Air Force, who's also been deployed, who also understands what life like is there. It's interesting to me that they always look to the government as an exempt an employee. That our job is the government, part of a job for a government employee is something sacrosanct to outside of the government. My other question is for those who say they should be exempt inside of government, where are they in the process of taking care of veterans not working for the government? Look, all veterans are the same to me. They've earned benefits. They've earned and served our country well. They're very protected and loved by me and wanting to be cared for, and that's what they will continue to get their care from, health care and benefits from the VA. But again, it's an interesting thing that we look at government employment as something different than employment outside. And, you know, again, to say that a veteran who's employed by the government is different than a veteran employed outside of government is just frankly not a valid argument.
A question about veteran care. We spoke with a veteran who's currently receiving inpatient treatment at the Bath VA Medical Center in New York. And this person says the cuts that the VA have instituted already are affecting the quality of care.
We've also had a lot of scheduled groups that are being canceled simply because we don't have the staff to facilitate them. And so that leaves us veterans to our own devices. And a lot of people just isolate in their rooms. And for people who suffer from substance use disorder or mental health issues, isolation is one of the worst things you can do, especially in recovery from substance use. To the administration who says there's no effect on veteran care, I say, you are absolutely wrong, and come here, and I will show you.
What's your response?
Well, my response is this is just a piece of journalism. It's not doing its job in the sense of you're picking a veteran who is saying that they're not getting care in a facility and in a health setting in which those jobs and others have been exempt. And so care that has been taken care of would not have been affected. And also, by the way, this has just happened within the last week. To say that there's this all of a sudden this dearth in care because of cuts that are happening here is simply not right. Remember, in these areas, we're also having, we've exempted 300,000 employees, and sometimes we're having to also, if someone leaves or goes away from that position, we're also having to hire. We're able to hire under, we're not under the hiring freeze for those positions, so we're trying to bring people in. But to blame this and simply use this event to blame it on cuts and blame it on what's happening right now with the VA is frankly not fair to the American people, and it's not fair to veterans who are hearing this thinking that something else is going on. This may be this person's perspective. I respect their position, but their position does not reflect what we've actually done.
How would a veteran like that be able to flag that concern and have it addressed in this new administration?
Well, they can go, you know, if they're having issues, they can talk to the people at the VA. They can talk to their schedulers. They can actually, again, as always happens here, and it's one of the things we got to get away from, if they're having problems with scheduling or scheduling's not happening, we have some issues in third-party scheduling or however they're trying to get their schedule made, is, look, reach out to your veterans service organization. Reach out to the our veteran crisis line. Talk to the people. Don't just simply sit there and think that you're by yourself. We have multitudes of resources to reach out to find out what's going on and to find out what's really happening. My concern is, though, is that people are being led or mistold things that are not actually affecting their specific care, and they're then trying to broaden it out to a more open attack on what they maybe positions that they don't understand or don't like.
Secretary Collins, we are out of time, but we invite you back anytime to continue this conversation. Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Doug Collins. Thank you.
Take care.
That was the Secretary of the Veterans Administration on the PBS NewsHour in this past week. Next, we have Native Land Podcasting. And guess what happened at the State of the Union?
Angela, you brought up the honorable representative from the great state of Texas, Al Green, I believe. I don't know his district number, but from the great state of Texas, who took up the armor of resilience, stood up to tell a fascist who thinks he's a king that no kings live here and he has no mandate. And y'all, let's take a look at what happened as a result of.
And it's the 9th district while we wait for that clip to roll.
Likewise, small business optimism saw its single largest one-month gain ever recorded, a 41-point jump.
Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House and to cease any further disruptions. That's your warning. Members are engaging in willful and continuing breach of decorum, and the chair is prepared to direct the sergeant-at-arms to restore order to the joint session. Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. That members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber. Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House.
That hurts me. I think that's probably why I wanted to see it stopped, because I kept having flashes of the bullies in the schoolhouse doorway. And I'm really angry at that clip because I averted my eyes from it before in real time because of the tepid shyness, cowardice of the Democrats sitting next to him, around him, behind him, along his walk, as he is heckled by his other side colleagues in the U.S. House of Representatives. J.D. Vance and his small man bullying disposition and attitude, right? We know that guy from high school. We know him from middle school. We play with him in the schoolyard. We know that character. He is eminently weak, right? Attempting to play like he's got strength. I'm mad about that clip because had I been orchestrating a genuine, authentic moment of resistance, he would have exited that chamber locked arms with the other 200 plus members of the other side of that house who call themselves the opposition. Instead, he was escorted alone in his full power and strength. I respect it. But shame.
Shame. You know, it's a lot of seriousness happening. And I just want to offer a brief moment of levity because I don't think he would mind me sharing this. But our good friend Michael Harriet texted us last night and said, man, if I get thrown out the club and y'all stay behind, it's like, yes, precisely. I was honestly disgusted watching what happened last night with the Democrats. But I wasn't just disgusted with what happened with the Democrats because, like I said, I'm not a party person. I was disgusted with what happened across media because the media displayed to you nothing, really. You know, they treated this entire address like it was normal. They had, you know, Trump people say this thing and somebody else, you know, the opposition say this. And they were engaged in debate when the reality is there were people who walked out. There were members of Congress who left that chamber. There was a movement of resistance. It's just that for whatever reason, across the board, the media has capitulated. I would imagine had our sister Joy Reid still had her show, had she been a part of the coverage, that you would have seen that resistance in real time. She would have referenced, just FYI, there are people exiting the chamber in real time, which is why journalism matters, which is why actual reporting matters. So I just,
which again, if you get your wish.
I get my wish. Oh, yes, because we have a clip of Joy. Yeah. Well, let's roll that clip.
Well, no, not of Joy, but of the real-time exits.
Well, let's play that.
Which is what you're calling us. Yeah.
And when we come back from this, I want to reference the censure that's been dropped, introduced on the House.
Of course.
We cannot normalize this. This man has no respect for Congress. He does not respect us as a co-equal branch of government. He has contempt for the American people. He pardoned January Sixers who desecrated the very well that we are in today for this joint address of Congress or State of the Union. So I don't need to be there for a MAGA pep rally, listening to lies and propaganda, hateful rhetoric, and even more hateful and harmful policies. If he has contempt for the American people, I'm going to stand in solidarity with the American people. And that is why I walked out in protest at 9:40. These boots were definitely made for walking. And again, I wanted to bring visibility to the story of the federal worker from my district who was fired unlawfully, unjustly. And it not only is disrupting her life and livelihood, but it's a disservice to the people that she serves every day.
Here was the general consensus is that, number one, this isn't a normal address. This isn't a normal time where you stand up when the president walks in, where you have that kind of decorum. Because, number one, he's never shown that to us or the American people or any people. He's never shown that to Black people. And so we walked in there, many of us, with a plan of what to do. If you've seen the videos, you've seen people with signs, holding up signs. I hold up a sign that said Musk steals. Elon Musk has been tweeting at me every other week. If I was the richest man on earth, I wouldn't be tweeting at 28-year-old Maxwell Frost, but I'd be doing other things. But I think there's power in occupying a space and choosing yourself when to get up and leave and walk out in the spirit of student protesters from the civil rights era. And that's why we decided to do it, us and a group of mainly women from the Black Caucus who helped lead us into that action.
You know me very well, and you know that I was not about to put up with that bullshit that he was going to talk about tonight. Angela, you know, you've been out there in Los Angeles. I've worked with gang members, the Crips, the Bloods, everybody. I've never encountered anybody like Trump. Trump is a person without a conscience. He will lie at the drop of a hat, and he knows that you know that he's lying, but he continues to lie.
Max is an OG, just like Al Green.
I follow their lead. I thank God for them. I really do, especially in this time. You know, as one of the younger members in the Congress, it is so important to have people that are always going to give us a sobering message about the moment that we're in. And as y'all just heard, she did not hold back. She gonna call that what he is at all times. And so, and I'm here for it. And what y'all don't know is we both from St. Louis. Listen, we from the show me state, okay? This is what you get out of St. Louis.
To all of you on this line, I want to say I needed to get on here to be refueled. Mm-hmm. And I think in this moment, it is going to require each of us to recognize what can I do in this moment. And so I just want to thank to the collective, to everybody who helped us get to this place. Now the real work begins. And as was said, they're using words like scrub, to scrub our history, to scrub us out of jobs. Even veterans who are one third of the workforce, they don't care.
What I think is so powerful, and again, you guys can call me on my bias here, but I got to tell you, what's so powerful to me about this is there are a lot of folks who Jasmine leads. Jasmine is my leader, okay?
Yes.
But Jasmine got her leadership from watching folks like Maxine Waters not stand for nothing, not take no ish, like, and she was so clear about it yesterday. I just love that moment between the two of them. It was longer than that. I hope folks get to go back and watch, but it was incredible to see them. The thing that I want to point out, too, as we talk about Mr. Green, you guys were mentioning that you felt like it was cowardice on behalf of the other members that let him get walked out. They actually really had a robust strategy. Maxwell goes into all of the considerations that at play when he addressed the state of the people in the Black Leadership Summit. They talked about whether or not to go, because if they didn't go at the beginning, white staffers would fill their seats. They talked about the importance of him having to face Black people. Even when you hear Lisa Blunt Rochester, which I know will be played in this show, all of the rationale that went into that. What I think is important is that there are some people that did something different, because now Dan Newhouse, who is a representative from my home state in Washington, has taken it upon himself to introduce a censure resolution against Congressman Green. What it means to be censured in the House chamber, the walk of shame that Mr. Green should not have walked yesterday, that should have been Donald Trump's walk of shame, because he was lying to the American people for over an hour. But he instead had to be escorted out by law enforcement, two people who look like him, in fact, but mostly white sergeant at arms officials, walked out of the chamber, has to be censured in the well of the Congress. What it means to be censured, and this is it's in the Constitution, is that the member of Congress has to stand before the body and be reprimanded for taking an action that is contrary to the House rules. So, and it could be something else. It could be a crime. There have been 27 members of Congress censured in history. Al Green would be censured, and you guys know who wouldn't be? Because they expect this vote to pass tomorrow when it comes up on the House floor. You know who wasn't censured? Joe Wilson, standing up before the American people, before Barack Obama's State of the Union address, addressing Obamacare, addressing the Affordable Care Act. He points to Barack Obama and yells, "You lie." Joe Wilson was merely reprimanded. Congressman Green should not be reprimanded, censured, or expelled for telling the American people the truth.
What if he refuses?
$800 billion in Medicaid that is going to be cut under this administration. That's what he's pointing out. If he refuses, I suspect that this will be escalated and they will want to expel him from the House of Representatives.
He definitely said in the post comments that I'll take whatever the reprimand is, because the harm that's coming toward people, the people I care about with this Medicaid cut, they're worth it. By and large, is what he said. My embarrassment was, if you looked at the frame of the Democrats who were seated next to him and around him, nearly every one of them averted their eyes, never looked at the congressman. They looked down. They looked around. They looked up at the speaker's rostrum. They did not look at their colleague who was being escorted, forcibly removed, because it wasn't by choice, from the chamber for stating a fact. I get decorum. Yeah. But I'm just saying the best laid plans of protests. I understand it. But sometimes a movement so big happens, so cataclysmic, it shadows everything else around it. And in those movements, it's go time.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
And
I appreciate
anyway.
What happened with those other members. Totally appreciate it with the other members who we've just showcased on this forum did by way of active protest. I think by and large, the Democrats need a family meeting.
Yeah.
And they need to decide if they are serious about what it means to be the opposition party, because disparate, disconnected forms of resistance or counter, quite frankly, don't break through to illuminate for the American people that there is a strong enough fist coming together to punch back.
I don't know if a family meeting is the thing, honestly, because when you...
I mean amongst them.
No, I know what you mean. That's what I'm saying, amongst them. I don't know if that's the thing, because them ain't us. And I feel like even if you put the entire party in a room, when you have Congresswoman Slotkin given the response, who Senator. Has been an opponent of DEI, who has not been supportive of progressive policies that support people of color, it sends a message. And so I don't know if you put, you know, this quote unquote big tent party in one room, because the message I'm getting from them is, look, we tried to mess around with y'all black folks. We tried to mess around with the LGBTQ community, and that didn't work for us. So we're going to go back and try to convince these white folks, who we have not gotten since Lyndon Johnson, since 1965. We're going to go back and try to appeal to them and try to seduce them to this party. And they keep getting the wrong message. So I don't know that a family meeting matters. I don't know that holding up paddles in the air matter. I think if I'm a person who's being crushed by the weight of a MAGA fascist system, I don't give a damn about your paddles. And then even I legit did not know what is the consequence for refusing censure. But I'm looking at the people who were expelled from Congress in recent history. There's been other people, but in recent history, we're talking about James Traficant. I'm old enough to remember. I was at CNN at the time. James Traficant was expelled. He was tricky. Okay. He was tricky. Like convicted of bribery, conspiracy. And then the other person is this clown, George Santos. George Santos is a Republican. And if you all can Google him, but
he's almost
just lied about
everything.
He's
as the president, but the president somehow can command the attention of the entire Congress and do a joint address and not have to be censured, expelled, removed, impeached, nothing. I'm clear about the contrast, but to Andrew's point, the family meeting is to let people know what time it is. There were more than 20 members of the Congressional Black Caucus that were with State of the People yesterday. They know what time it is. They got to go deliver the message to these white members, including Senator Slotkin, who you referenced, Tiff. If they want to go be Dixiecrats, we ain't about to be part of this. That has to be the message.
Sorry.
It's okay.
I want the people to know she's a senator, so thank you.
My hope is
maybe she need to be demoted
too. 20 members.
But honey, can we do that? Because Lord have mercy.
My hope is that those 20 members will be the tip of the spear for the kind of about face that is required. Your protest cannot be calibrated to what is acceptable to the opposition. Yeah. Your protest must be calibrated to the scale of the threat that you are confronting. I'm not mad. I understand people are feeling and reaching into the darkness, trying to find what is the best way in which to do this thing. This is a time to check in with your conscience, your heart, your backbone, and your people, the ones that elected you there to represent them. That ought to dictate then what it is that you do. But this right now, right here, is not going to get it. It ain't going to get it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I just want us to be clear. Like, you guys, I want to say on this show, Congressman Al Green, you are a champion. You are a hero. Yeah. I've been mad at you waving that cane. I'm so glad you waved that cane yesterday. Like, it was a necessary prop. Especially when the props that have been making their way around the White House are things like Reverend Jamal Harrison Bryant's head, right? Like, you waving that cane to save Medicaid, you the people's champ, and the people need to recognize it. Your bravery is noted, your courage is seen, and I know that you're having to balance this with the loss of your friend, Congressman Sylvester Turner, who is also the mayor of Houston. Of course, he just passed away, hours after the State of the Union address yesterday. He's not been in Congress, but since January. So there's a lot that people are having to balance their personal lives, their what's happening nationally, what's happening internationally. And what we know is that this moment requires all of us to do something different. If it's abnormal, then we've got to use abnormal strength. We've got to find abnormal energy. We got to create abnormal coalitions. We got to relieve ourselves of abnormal grudges. We've got work to do, and it's going to require all of our hands.
And now, for a moment of clarity.
Well, that was rich. This whole evening was just filled with a lot of stuff. Elise, I want to start with you on an aspect of this, which I thought was, how should we put it, rich. It was a rich moment for me when Trump talked about an unelected bureaucracy. Mm. Let's take a quick listen to that, please.
We have hundreds of thousands of federal workers who have not been showing up to work. My administration will reclaim power from this unaccountable bureaucracy, and we will restore true democracy to America again. And any federal bureaucrat who resists this change will be removed from office immediately. Because we are draining the swamp. It's very simple. And the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over.
So there were two aspects of that that I thought were rich. One, the bobbleheads behind the president voted for those bureaucrats in that bureaucracy that they're now sitting there watching be deconstructed with broad smiles on their face. Second, the most obvious unelected bureaucrat at the center of all of this is Elon Musk. And I think for me, at least, as I hope for a lot of Americans, they're beginning to see now just how dangerous this proposition could be. What was your take in contextualizing that moment against the backdrop of this evening?
It is interesting to me how Elon Musk has done a pretty good job of making Donald Trump still feel relatively unthreatened. Why would you give Elon Musk a prime seat at your State of the Union to highlight that he has a front and centered role as an unelected bureaucrat?
The thing about the moment for me that, and if for folks, if you really want to understand the difference between Republican control and Democratic acquiescence, it's in how two things happened in that chamber and how they were handled. When Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert stood up and showed their behinds on the House floor, right, when they just act a fool, shouting and talking and being loud and disruptive, what happened?
They stayed.
Democrats didn't threaten them. Democrats didn't tell them to sit your behind down and shut up. Right? Order in the House.
What should have happened tonight?
Because the Republicans weren't coming to play. They weren't going to give the Democrats the quarter. They knew what they were going to do. They knew they were going to try to be disruptive in some form. And their goal was to shut it down in one of two ways. And both of them worked. USA, USA, as if they own that. You know, that moniker, and throw them out.
I guess you mean what should have the Democrats done instead of
throwing them out?
No, I'm talking about tonight. Should the Democrats have done tonight instead of what they did?
Some of us believe they shouldn't have shown up. Or if they showed up at a certain point, here's the deal. When the congressman was kicked out, half that room should have left with him. Because that was the point. He was the only one to stand up and say, I'm not going to sit here and let you lie in this chamber. I'm not going to let you get away with this because you're lying right now. And instead of calling the man a lie, like they did to Barack Obama.
Right. I remember I was there.
Right?
And nothing happened.
What happened then?
He got a pat on the wrist after.
I think there's what happened tonight.
I thought
thought she did a fantastic job. I thought that she kept it short also, which is such an advantage that so many politicians just underestimate. Mm-hmm. People are going to actually pay attention to the substance of what she said. She was very clear, plain, eloquent. Mm-hmm. She didn't, there wasn't any drama. She didn't need to add any drama to what she was saying because the reality is already there. She was telling the truth, but it came across in just a very simple, straightforward way that I think more Democrats could be smart to emulate.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I thought she did a very good job because that's a very tough thing to do, to follow any president.
Killed many a career.
Yes. Killed many a career. She didn't need a drink of water.
I know, right? I was about to say that.
But I think the Slotkin piece tonight, if they're really creative folks inside the bubble with the Democrats right now, to juxtapose pieces, if I'm doing an ad tomorrow, which mm-hmm. I would be doing right now from the DNC chair, I would have my folks put up an ad tomorrow to play in some key areas, pieces from Trump's speech with Slotkin's response, and begin to set the narrative, mm-hmm. the narrative contrast. Because the fight for the House began tonight, folks.
Well, it started 3 months ago.
No, but it actually began in earnest tonight politically. I think a lot of folks now, particularly given what you've already described as the energy, the angst inside the Democratic Party for what some would argue is the failure to seize the moment by a proactive action, mm-hmm. right? I think they can begin now to take some steps to sort of reframe this conversation for the country that I think is ready for that reframing,
yeah.
given everything that's been happening, what we're seeing happening in red states and town hall meetings, what we're seeing happen with members now, the Republicans being told, hey, no more town hall meetings, y'all, right?
Don't actually talk to the people who put you in office and that you serve and who pay your salary. Nope. Be a coward.
I love it.
Are you going to literally tell these people whose people in their district are saying, I want you to fight for me? There's sound from a town hall where someone stood up and said, please, just we'll be with you. Just do something.
Well, I know a thing or two about steely spines. So
yes, we know.
I really appreciate that.
I did that for you.
Thank you very much. I really do appreciate that. But there's a lot of value in what you're saying, Simone, because you're right. It's not going to get solved in a television ad. It's not going to get solved in anything you send across the transom on people's phones. It's a combination of a lot of things that have to come together, and at the core of that is action. Mm. And this in this age where you see at least one party doing and taking all kinds of actions, right? Whether you like them or not, there's activity. And what it's doing, if you've noticed, is it's emboldening the Republicans in a way in which dissent becomes much more difficult. The tighter, the more active, the harder it is. You don't have that right now on the Democratic side in a way that I thought maybe they could have begun to do that tonight. Let them, to your point, let the members express themselves. Smack them on the hand tomorrow morning, but create that link of that moment of action for them so they can begin to see, okay, yeah, now we can coalesce around and yeah, we'll take the hit on the hand and the public may or may not like everything that we did, but at least they know one thing about us. We're ready to fight.
You know who's giving to Democrats tonight? People that support Al Green. His coffers are being filled because they're like, that's a member that's fighting for me. And I'm like, baby, you live in Nebraska. Al Green is actually not your representative.
and just sending them all the money.
Okay.
Did you receive a call or message that mentioned Social Security and demanded immediate action? Did the caller know your Social Security number or other personal information and tell you that your Social Security number had been used in connection with the crime? Did you feel worried that your Social Security number might be suspended, your bank account might be frozen or seized, or you could be arrested? That is not the Social Security Administration. Social Security will not threaten you, demand your personal information or instant payment, email or text you pictures or documents, or use a real government official's name to gain your trust. Social Security does not accept payments by gift card, prepaid debit card, internet currency, or by mailing cash. Criminals use these forms of payment because they are hard to trace. Do not be fooled. Hang up. Ignore them. report this criminal activity to the Social Security Administration Office of the Inspector General at oig.ssa.gov.
Produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.
Do you know a veteran in need? After leaving the military, many veterans struggle to find their way home. Because to a veteran, home isn't just a place, it's an idea, a feeling. Nation's Finest understands the challenges veterans face. Through the VA's Supportive Services for Veteran Families program, we help veterans and their families struggling with rent, employment, and other housing-related costs. Today, Nation's Finest operates more than 30 locations in California, Arizona, and Nevada. For more than 50 years, we've helped thousands of veterans in these communities build happy, healthy, and purposeful lives. And our team is committed to supporting those who've served in their families for another 50. To get help, visit nationsfinest.org or call 1-833-468-9676. That's 1-833-468-9676.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
We can secure our world. Watch out for offers too good to be true. That's phishing. Someone's trying to take advantage of you.
Learn how to recognize and report phishing at cisa.gov/secure-our-world.
WRCT Pittsburgh. WRCT.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about homelessness. It's an epidemic in the United States with little or no governmental efforts to solve this human crisis.
Our guest today is Patrick McKee, a scholar on how we've gotten to this sorry state of affairs and what it will take to reverse course and end this shameful situation. Next on Law and Disorder, as the Trump administration continues to punish faculty and students who dare to protest Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, academic freedom is on the chopping block.
Hello, I'm DJ Firefly. It's time for Couch Dancing at WRCT Pittsburgh. Starting out this show with Pernell March and the tune Melissa's Meditation from Ozone Parade.